Sky News understands that 4-year-old Hamza Khan, who was starved to death by his mother, has still not been buried. Amanda Hutton, who has 7 other children, was jailed earlier for 15 years. Hamza died in 2009, but his mummified remains were not discovered until 2011. Our reporter Becky Johnson explains why Hamza has still not been laid to rest.
His body is still in a mortuary in this city of Bradford because, it's sad to say, it was used in evidence at this trial, so it has not yet been released to the family for a burial.
Health Secretary Jeremy Hunt says the government's taking action to bring down waiting times in hospitals' A&E departments. NHS England says 39 departments failed to meet the government's target to see 95% of patients within 4 hours between July and September. Max Clifford has pleaded not guilty to indecent assaults on women. He faces 11 charges relating to 7 alleged victims between 1966 and 1984. I'm a Celebrity star Nadine Dorries and her fellow Tory MP Simon Burns are both bidding to replace Nigel Evans as Deputy Speaker of the House of Commons. Mr. Evans left the role last month after being accused of sex offences, which he denies. Twitter is hoping to raise $1 billion, more than £600 million, by floating on the US stock market. The San Francisco-based social network used a tweet to announce it and filed papers outlining its plans. Mike Butcher is the editor of the website TechCrunch Europe. He says that compared to Facebook's 800 million users, Twitter is still relatively junior.
Twitter only has 215 million users and has got plenty of growth left in it. So effectively, it's kind of floating really at the right time when there's lots of growth left and the public markets and investors will be able to capitalise on that growth.
And dozens of giant grommet sculptures have raised over £2 million at auction in Bristol. That's the latest. I'm Andy Hayes.
BCFM.
Representing the entire city,
this is BCFM.
BCFM 93.2.
Hello, it's Friday, 5 o'clock, and BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. And helping us review this week's news is Lib Dem councillor for Cabot Ward, Mark Wright. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, as usual, is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, 10 months in the job, but has she made a difference? And more importantly, what aspect of our police force is she going to privatise? Joined by Avon and Somerset's Police and Crime Commissioner Sue Mount-Stevens. Also, we originally invaded after 9/11 in 2001 on a mission to find bin Laden. Joe Baker takes us back today through our 12-year occupation of Afghanistan, already longer than both world wars put together. The British Army are constantly warning us about the dangers of the Taliban getting back into power there, but if the Afghan people want it, so what? Joe will be looking at some of the big, longer-term effects of the British presence there. And plus, Martin Summers takes us on his weekly tour of the world's hotspots. That's all in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 13 Celsius, some light rain. This weekend, highs of 20, cloudier on Saturday, sunnier on Sunday. Next week, highs of 20, still keeping very warm, fairly sunny week. Next weekend, the 12th and 13th of October, highs down a little bit to 16 Celsius, sunshine and showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So anyway, helping us review this week's news is Lib Dem councillor for Cabot Ward, Mark Wright. Hi, Mark. And welcome to Drive Time. First of all, you were in the cabinet. Why not anymore?
Because our group does these things by votes, and a few years ago a different cabinet was voted in and I wasn't in them.
What were you doing before? Just remind us.
It was
actually a Lib Dem cabinet, to be fair, wasn't it? Not Mayor Ferguson.
No, that's right. Yeah, this is going back some time now. This is going back to 2009, 10 and 11. Historically, I was a scientist and then a computer programmer and then a politician, and now I'm a scientist and computer programmer again.
Okay, now let's just go straight to a discussion about this Tory conference this week. I mean, I've kind of tried to avoid these party conferences because I just see them as rather cheap marketing exercise. I don't know, do you go to your Liberal Democrat conference?
I do occasionally, not when it's in Glasgow because that's too far away and I have to take too many days off holiday, but in the past I certainly did go to quite a few of them, yeah.
Okay, but you haven't been recently. I mean, what are your thoughts about what's the value of for a politician like yourself, should we say small local politician? Because in the old days, of course, these party conferences were where policy was decided. Nowadays, they seem to be much more like just announcements by the leadership.
Yeah, I think, for local politicians and people who aren't MPs and stuff, we have to be honest and say that the main reason to go to party conference is for networking and socialising, meeting other people,
drinking,
talking about stuff. There may be an element of drinking, probably not quite as much these days as there was in the old days, but... You know, the Lib Dem party, we still, of course, do vote on policy. Whether that policy then becomes government policy, of course, is a more complex issue.
Well, it's not policy then, is it? I mean, surely the idea is... I mean, Ron Stone was on here last week saying he used to go along to Labour conferences, and a local branch here in Bristol could put forward a motion, if it was well argued on the conference floor, the leadership would have to adopt it. Now, those days are gone. Why?
Well, like I said, I mean, I would maintain they're still not gone in the Lib Dems. Party conference can still make party policy. Like I say, the situation we've got now, though, is that Lib Dem party policy won't necessarily be implemented because we're in a coalition. Why did other parties in generally move away from it? I think basically they moved away from it because their respective parties, both the Labour Party and the Tory Party, their party members were, shall we say, further from the mainstream than their MPs were, and they were foisting upon them policies that their MPs didn't agree with, and their leaders certainly didn't agree with, and they thought were liabilities, and so they wanted to get rid of.
But they're not foisting anything on anyone in a democratic meeting, are they? If everyone is voting, and the membership are voting on an issue, the party leaders, surely they should just be picking up those issues and running with them.
Yeah, I suppose. The reality is, if you don't agree with something, even if it's democratic, then it still seems like it's being foisted, and that was the reality.
As an ordinary member, if you want, and a councillor for the Lib Dems, don't you feel that sometimes the leadership are foisting policies on you?
Indeed. I mean, that's unfortunately what leaders do. That's why they're called leaders, I guess. It's a funny old system. You know, you elect your leader, and then he tells you what to do. You know, and that's the strange beast that politics is.
Because I think it was at the spring conference for the Lib Dems, there was a discussion, I believe, on the Snoopers Charter, and a vote to say that the Lib Dems wouldn't be supporting the Snoopers Charter.
That's right,
but then that was overturned by Nick Clegg and the leadership.
Yeah, indeed. That was very disappointing, and it upset a lot of people in the party. And to be fair, what they've done now, David Laws has come back in the last couple of months and said that he's going to create a new party policy on the whole secret court things, which will be our policy going into the next general election, which will be to change the system that Parliament have just voted in, because it's not ideal, there's no doubt about that.
But you mean, you mentioned David Laws, he's a bit of a naughty boy, isn't he? He's a local MP, and he lied in the over the MP's expenses. I think it was something like £25,000 claimed that he shouldn't have done.
Yeah, that he did. Yeah, you asked me this question last time I was on here, in fact. I mean, in his defence, he claimed less money than he could have done if he had simply admitted that the man who was living with him was his partner. And of course, he hadn't told his mum at that point that he was gay. So it's not ideal. He did break the rules. He did pay it back, and he lost his cabinet seat as a cabinet position as a result of it. But I think, I would argue, he's done his time. It was an honest mistake born out of trying to live a double life and not telling anyone he was gay.
Also, Stephen Williams, our local MP here, he voted yes to attack Syria. Do you agree with that?
He didn't vote yes to attack Syria. He voted yes to intervene. As for whether I agree with it, I did agree with the vote, actually, because I think that using chemical weapons is a moral red line that cannot be left.
But you've got to find out who's done it first, surely.
Yeah, I don't think that anyone other than Vladimir Putin is really disputing the evidence of the fact that it was the Syrian.
Well, I think the United Nations have been, and the Turks have been found rebels with sarin.
I don't think there are shells here, there, and everywhere. Of old chemical weapon stores, but the coordinated attack on that particular night. I don't think there's any doubt that that was done by Syrian forces. Even Hezbollah, who are allied with the Syrian government forces, think that it was Syrian government forces who did it. Having said all of this, I think that the resolution that's now come out of this, which is that the Syrian government will dispose of and destroy all of its weapons, is a good result. I do think that that result has come as a result of the threat of military force. I don't think that that result would have come if Bashar Assad hadn't thought that he was about to have his key positions bombed. But nevertheless, it is a good result that's come. I don't want.
So you're convinced personally, even sitting here in Bristol, that it actually was Assad's government and Assad's forces that carried out that attack?
Absolutely. I don't think Bashar Assad himself ordered it. I think it was probably his crazy brother who runs one of the wings of the Syrian army, and who is it's a bit like Saddam and his sons. Saddam's sons were much nastier and more dangerous than he was, and it seems that Assad's family is even more nasty and dangerous than he is.
So if Britain had fired 30 or 40 cruise missiles at Syria, you think that would have been useful?
I think it would have sent a necessary message that you cannot use chemical weapons and not have an international response. But as I said, the outcome that has come as a result instead is a better outcome, that they're going to dispose of their weapons and that no bombs were dropped. That's clearly.
Well, in a way, it's lucky then that you lost that vote, you and Stephen.
You could argue that. That's a fair thing
anyway,
to argue.
Anyway, back on to the party conferences, veering off a little bit there. Britain is on the right track. This is George Osborne. Are you convinced of that?
Me?
Yeah.
Britain's on the right track. Well, the economy is scheduled to grow by, already between 1% and 2% now in the next year, which is, I think, going to be one of the highest in Europe. So,
but I mean, we had this whole thing, didn't we, in the 2010. George Osborne promised, and Cameron promised, to be fair to them. By 2015, we're going to balance the budget, they said. Now, it now looks that's very, very unlikely. So the tune has changed at this party conference to, OK, well, we will balance the books by... Actually, no, we will put the country into surplus by 2020. Are you convinced of that?
Well, I don't think the country will be in surplus by 2020. Number one reason, because the Tories won't win the next election and they won't get to implement their policy ideas.
So we'll still be in the red, will we?
I think that we will probably still
be in the red. And the Lib Dems will be in charge, maybe?
Who knows? It could well be. I suspect we probably still will be in the red. I think... Looking back, the five-year closing the deficit was ambitious. It was based on the idea that there would be a global recovery very quickly. I think that was always flawed. Even in going back to late 2009, I remember being in council debates saying that we should look to the situation in Japan during the lost decade as a model for what would happen globally, that this would take at least a decade to recover from. So given that and the euro crisis, which I don't think anyone other than a handful of economic doomsayers saw, that there was a major European currency crisis coming in 2010 and 11, and that has really set the European recovery back badly.
Well right on cue, economic doomsayers, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Martin, we had this, as I was saying to Mark just now, 2010, the budget's going to be balanced, supposedly, anyway. That's what they said. And now they're saying that by 2020, they've scotched that, and now it's that we're going to be in surplus by 2020.
Well, I think the fact that they're not balancing the budget is probably linked to the fact that the economy is starting to grow slightly. So in other words, by stopping banging their head on a brick wall, things start to improve. But don't forget, the economy was growing when the coalition took over, and the talk of cuts and the desire to create an austerity atmosphere actually caused the economy to retrench. It's going to take us several years to get back to where we were before the crisis. And that, don't forget, there was some growth in the economy. Coalition then dropped the ball. The growth went away. We lost our AAA credit rating, which was supposedly the holy grail of the whole policy. That's just been brushed under the carpet. I mean, we could have lost our AAA credit rating by spending money instead of by cutting. And in actual fact, we'd have had a lot more GDP if we'd done that. But anyway, the real problem is that the banking system is still bankrupt. And that's nothing to do with government policy.
Well, I have sort of tried to avoid doing these party conference things, but we're going to have a bit of David Cameron's speech now, where he fairly and squarely puts the economic difficulties we're having today right at Labour's doorstep.
Our economy may be turning the corner, and of course that's great, but we still haven't finished paying for Labour's debt crisis. If anyone thinks that's over, done and dealt with, They are living in a fantasy land. The country's debt crisis, created by Labour, is not over. After 3 years of cuts, we still have one of the biggest budget deficits anywhere in the world. We are still spending more than we earn. We still need to earn more, and yes, our government still needs to spend less. Now, I see that Labour have stopped talking about the debt crisis, and now they talk about the cost of living crisis, as if one wasn't directly related to the other. And if you want to know what happens if you don't deal with a debt crisis, and how it affects the cost of living, just go and ask the Greeks. So finishing the job means sticking to our course until we've paid off all of Labour's deficit, not just some of it. And yes, let us run a surplus so this time we fix the roof when the sun is shining, as George said in that brilliant speech on Monday. To abandon deficit reduction now would throw away all the progress that we've made. It would put us back to square one. And unbelievably, that is what Labour now want to do. How did they get us into this mess? Too much spending, too much borrowing, too much debt. And what did they propose last week? More spending, more borrowing, more debt. They have learnt nothing, literally nothing, from the crisis they created.
Well, I would say that they've learnt nothing from the last 5 years of being in power. In actual fact, we could, in fact, have probably bumbled along running a deficit and keeping economic growth going. We might still have lost our AAA credit rating, but we'd have kept economic growth going in the economy. The real problem, he's talking about Greece there, the real problem, as I stress in my final point just before that clip, is that the banking system and the financial system is still absolutely bankrupt. When Ben Bernanke the other day talked about reducing quantitative easing in the US, the stock markets all over the world threw a fit, and everybody is in denial about the fact that the financial system, the private financial system, which is the source of the crisis, is still bankrupt.
Okay,
Labour government in Britain is absurd.
Why don't you just address that main point that David Cameron's making there? This is Labour's deficit. He's absolutely right about that.
Well, the deficit we've got now is their deficit, let's be clear, because it's
Yes, but the big spike in government borrowing and the national debt happened in 2008, and David Cameron, the Conservatives, all the Lib Dems, none of them were in power then.
Well, that's true, and of course, but they all supported, David Cameron and Nick Clegg both supported the bailout of the banks. Now, we could have followed a free market policy, and I've got respect for those who argue in favour of that, the Austrian school economists, but that means allowing the banking system to collapse. That's not what's happened in the US, it's not what's happened in Britain. We've actually made the taxpayer on the hook to bail out the private banking system. That's why we're running up a big public deficit, because basically private debts have been socialised.
Okay, so your Prime Minister Gordon Brown didn't save the world after all.
No, he didn't, and that was one of the problems we've got, is that Labour then bailed out the banking system, and then of course tried to pretend that by doing that they'd saved the world, and then tried to win the election on the back of that. They didn't turn around to people and say, actually, private capitalism is over, because of course that's not the sort of thing new Labour type people say. But the fact of the matter is, private capitalism is over, and that's why I'm a socialist, and I'm sure Mark's going to disagree with me.
I agree with pretty much everything you said there. One of the things I do disagree with is I don't think that we had the liberty of not turning around in 2010 and saying that we were going to attempt to vigorously get the deficit under control, because I think there were a run on a number of currencies at that point. Obviously the euro was the main one, but also Iceland and a number of other countries with high deficits, where international markets didn't believe that those countries were going to be able to get their deficits under control. It wouldn't just have been about losing the ratings, our AAA rating. It would have been potentially about having a currency crisis, which could have really crippled the country. Now, you might have said, there's probably only a 20% chance of Britain succumbing to a currency crisis if we just say we're not going to get the deficit under control. And that therefore there's an 80% chance that we could have, as you say, survived with a bigger deficit and with higher growth. But there is a 20% chance that we could have gone Argentinian-style currency bankrupt, and that would have destroyed the economy for pensioners and a number of other of the most vulnerable people.
Yeah, what about that, Martin?
Well, actually, I mean, we can say this now because we're talking with hindsight. What any government should have done, the Coalition or Labour, is say that you're going to get the deficit under control. And, of course, Labour had its own extended... I mean, basically, what Osborne is saying is we will get it under control, but not in the timescale that we originally said, which is basically what Labour was saying. We will get it under control, but not in that timescale. So, in other words, if it was the case that it could cause a currency crisis then, well, it could cause a currency crisis now to say the same thing. But the real trick, of course, is to say you're going to get it under control, and then it unavoidably slips. So you're saying one thing to the financial markets and another thing to your supporters. But ultimately, of course, the real problem is that the financial system needs complete root and branch reform. We shouldn't be paying the banks which we have bailed out are then put one hat on their head and say, now you've got to pay back the debts you owe us as banks. But hang on, we've just bailed you out. So in other words, we've got a middleman there, as it were, who lends us the money, but we have to lend them the money to lend us back. Now ultimately, that's not sustainable.
Now, how this has gone in the US, Mark, of course, is we've heard this week about the shutdown of quite large parts of the federal government. I mean, if you look at the national debt graph, you can see it's going up at a rate of knots. We passed last year the 1 trillion mark. We're now around about 1.2 trillion national debt. We are basically heading down that road, exactly the same road as to the US. In a few years' time, they'll be saying, well, actually, we don't have any money to pay any civil servants and there is no government. So people will be asking, why are we paying taxes and why are we voting?
Well, I think, I mean, obviously...
They are in the States today. They're saying, what are we doing paying taxes if most of the government has had to shut down?
Yeah, indeed. Although, I think... To be fair, in America, the shutdown is less actually about the deficit and the debt, and it's more about a clique of fanatical Republicans who are still can't get over the fact that Obama won the presidential election last year, and they want to kill his signature policy, which he just won an election on. And they're also self-harming the economy. It's most sane Republicans, and there are some. Think that what the Tea Party are forcing upon the country is suicide politics and suicide economics. It's not actually going to help anyone do anything. And a lot of the people who are losing out in the federal spending, for example, veterans cashing in their checks and all that kind of thing. Those are not the kind of people who you want to hurt. I don't think that's not going to be an issue over here in Britain. Again, I mean, no country ever pays off its national debt. I mean, ultimately, it's just a case of...
Well, I don't think you can say it won't happen here, because if you look at the national debt graph in Britain, it's climbing at a ridiculous rate. You're talking about sort of, I don't know, whatever it is, about 80 degrees up, fast. And that's what's happened in the States, is the banks have gone to the government, and the financial sector has gone to the government, and also, of course, the legislators are on their side, basically the Republicans are, and they've said, well, I'm sorry, you can't have any more money. You know, that's it. It's a bit like the loan shark that's been around one too many times.
Well, I mean, ultimately, Alan Greenspan was always fond of saying, the American government will never default on its debt, because if it runs out of money, it will just print some more and hand that over as the debt. I mean, this is the make-believe financial nonsense at the base of all of these kind of government borrowing arguments, is that when it comes to the crunch, government can simply magic money out of the air if it needs to. And the Bank of England has kind of been doing this with quantitative easing. You know, we don't call it magic money because that upsets people, so they call it, weird names that nobody's ever heard of.
Or printing money or QE.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing. Yeah, exactly. I mean, like I say, the issue is not that the debt is big. The issue is that the deficit, so the amount of which the debt is growing each year, is big as well. That's what really is upsetting people. You know, if that could be got down to, a much lower rate of increase, then people are generally pretty relaxed about that, because national governments can typically carry about 100% of their annual earnings in debt without upsetting too many people. It's the rate of growth that's the bothersome thing.
Okay, well, let's now just cut to the end of David Cameron's keynote speech at the Conservative Party conference on Wednesday and have a listen to that.
Whenever we've had the choice of giving in to some shabby compromise or pushing forward to something better, we've said this is Great Britain, the improbable hero of history. The country that doesn't give in, that doesn't give up, that knows there's no such thing as destiny, only our determination to succeed. So I look forward to our future, and I'm confident. There are battles to fight, but beyond this hall are the millions of hard-working people who renew the great in Great Britain every day. In the way they work, in the way they give, in the way they raise their families, These are the people we have alongside us. Together, we have made it this far. Together, we will finish the job we've started. And together, we will build that land of opportunity.
Well, even cheers there, Martin.
Well, it's the Tory Party conference. I'm sure they're cheering. If they weren't, they shouldn't be there. Improbable victory. Improbable. What was it? The improbable victors of history. That's a very interesting phrase. I mean, that is just boilerplate, really. It sounds like something from The Office when David Brent giving a team talk, isn't it? I mean, what do you expect,
Mark?
Yeah, I mean, I'm slightly nervous of criticising it in case you play an identical-ish threat from the Lib Dem conference.
And there'll be one from Labour as well.
Yeah, exactly. The reality is that all conferences are like this. You know, you spend the final speech of the leader, you spend half of it knocking the opposition, a quarter of it speaking about policies, and then a quarter of it just fluffing everyone up, making them feel happy, saying, you know, aren't we great and isn't the country great?
Okay, well, let's hear a couple of more interesting bits. This one is from George Osborne's speech, I think was on Monday.
We held our nerve in the face of huge pressure. Now Britain is turning a corner. And that is down to the resolve and to the sacrifice of the people of this country. And for that support, we owe the British people a huge, heartfelt thank you. Thanks to you, Britain is on the right track. So now...
Oops. I don't think the audience quite knew they were supposed to be cheering at that point. Very embarrassing, horrible kind of pregnant pause in the middle of Osborne's speech. And I just think his delivery is appalling, the way he doesn't even sound like he believes it himself. So let's skip on and have a listen to another highlight, for me anyway. This was when I think it was from the Royal Fusiliers, Colonel from the Royal Fusiliers stood up during the Defence Secretary's Philip Hammond's speech.
Let's. They are serving us now as they always serve us, round the clock. Gentlemen, 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 would you like to sit down? Would you like to sit down? I'll come and talk to you happily later on. Let me complete my speech. Thank you very much.
I asked Mr. Hammond to tell the truth about how 2RRF was suddenly selected for disbandment last year. He himself has said quite clearly in Hansard that the Fusiliers were not originally on the list for disbandment. After a meeting at the later part of planning, suddenly we were. My real fear is that the cuts are not being made on the basis of sound military judgment and logic. 2RRF last year were the best recruited infantry battalion in the army. I haven't finished speaking and neither have the Fusiliers. This is only the start. This isn't the finish, and there is going to be accountability. It will not be allowed to rest as it is now. The public have a right to know, and it's about time we got the truth.
Well, that was a former, retired anyway, colonel in the Royal Fusiliers. Martin, can you remember the army coming into any party conferences before and interrupting the Defence Secretary? It's the first time I can ever remember anything like this happening.
Well, I mean, it's certainly the stage managers will have been annoyed with that, but...
I mean, he was saying basically, I mean, we heard a little clip of him afterwards, that's Colonel Ian Brazier with his captain, Joe Eastwood, who stood next to him, who didn't want to sit down, and they were saying basically that they have simply refused to answer their letters about what's happening with their regiment.
Well, I think the army are complaining because, of course, they do most of the frontline stuff, and why are we buying aircraft carriers, for example, which we haven't got any aircraft for, and Trident missiles, which we're never going to use, and we're cutting infantry regiments. Hang on a minute, those seem to be the people who do most of the actual stuff. So I think they've definitely got a point. And I think also they are actually, you know, they're basically, the Tories always use the armed forces as, you know, the armed forces, aren't they wonderful? And the point is that the armed forces are not to be used as a political football in that way. I mean, the armed forces, I mean, look at the stuff that happened about Ralph Miliband, and the Mail was saying that he hated British institutions, he hated the Queen, he hated the Church, and he hated the Army. And if he hated the Army, it's because he served in the Navy during the war.
Well, there are tens of thousands of people actually part of this Save the Fusiliers campaign, Mark. Do you think it's acceptable for old soldiers to come along, join the Tory party a few weeks before the conference, turn up and stand up and interrupt speeches?
Well, in a way, he should be thankful he didn't end up arrested, of course. I mean, famously, Walter Wolfgang, was it, or whatever,
that's
did this
right,
at the Labour Party and ended up having
under
a
terrorism
run in,
legislation.
That's right, having a run-in with the police. So, I mean, at least he didn't get his collar felt. I mean, he has got a point, actually, and I think, as Martin said, this whole thing of, the spending on Trident, we don't need to be cutting our armed forces at a time when we seem to be using them more, more than at any point probably since the, since the Korean War or since the Second World War even. We should be looking really at these silly, posturing that we're doing with our new round of nuclear weapons, and we could be modernising these guys' regiments instead of cutting them if we weren't spending $80 billion on a nuclear weapon system which is designed for the Cold War.
So you're in coalition. What are you doing to stop it?
Well, as part of the coalition agreement, we got some of the decisions on the procurement of the new system delayed until after the next general election, which means that it's still possible if a party that is opposing a like-for-like replacement wins the next general election. And I think, quite a lot of people were hoping that the Labour Party might come out and say that they would do that, although it looks increasingly likely that they won't, that they will in fact copy the Tories and go for like-for-like replacement. Then, there's still a chance to cancel it. The Lib Dems have brought forward a policy of what we're calling stepping down the nuclear ladder, which is not scrapping it outright, but deciding that instead of having continuous at sea nuclear deterrent, whereby we always have a nuclear submarine at sea loaded up with nukes ready to go, within 50 seconds should the scenario arise, which of course it never will. Instead, what we're proposing, I think, is that we'll have two subs, and that it will take, if the subs at sea are not the ones which happen to be loaded, then it will take some number of days to, days or weeks to get them back, get them loaded up, and all the rest of it. But in reality, there's not going to be a nuclear scenario bump up within 45 minutes that has to be responded to, as we saw even in Syria and things like that. These scenarios, they take days and weeks to materialise. We don't need to spend the whole lot. We can start to decommission nuclear weapons slowly, going down one step at a time, starting by getting rid of the continuous at-sea defence, and then maybe in 20 years' time go down to no subs at sea, and then maybe, in 30 years' time put the nukes into, mothball them into cupboards and expect never to use them again, and start to melt them down and, use up the plutonium in
just be careful
reactors.
The way you melt them down, be careful.
Well, quite, yeah. I mean, obviously.
Don't stick them in an oven or something. Anyway, on to another story. And the Daily Mail this week, really cannot not talk about this. The Mail last weekend, at the beginning of the week anyway, came out with an attack on Ed Miliband's father. What are your thoughts about that? Because, certainly some of the Daily Mail readers I've spoken to actually even don't seem to think that this is acceptable.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's ridiculous, to be honest. I mean, they haven't broken any law. They've just been grossly distasteful in attacking a dead man for something he said when he was 17. When he was 17 in the 1930s and 40s, when, to be perfectly fair, a large chunk of the population there was communism around, there was fascism around. People were talking and discussing. It wasn't massively obvious to people in the 30s. To most people in the 30s, that both communism and fascism would lead to mass murder on epic scales. That wasn't obvious at that particular point in history. And to judge a dead man by what he said in those days is just completely ridiculous. Now, from my point of view, I've actually think this has been absolutely great, because everybody now is giving the Daily Mail a good kicking, and it's about bloody time.
Just to apologise to listeners for swearing there, but Martin.
Well, I think they've shot themselves in the foot, because it's open. It just looks so tacky, doesn't it? I mean, the Miliband family were Jewish refugees from Nazi Germany, and they were left-wingers, and so there were two reasons for them to flee Nazi Germany. Ralph Miliband, incidentally, was not a communist. He was always opposed to the Soviet Union. His books, which were quite interesting, are mostly about Britain. And I saw Michael Heseltine came out and said that this was silly, and some of his ex-students, who are now Tory MPs, have come out and said how silly this all is. But I think what we could start asking questions about who was David Cameron's father. And David Cameron's father, of course, made his money setting up hedge funds in the Cayman Islands and the Bahamas for people to avoid tax.
But I feel like I ought to
always, how he got the money to
Martin,
save the
I feel like
reason.
I almost ought to kick you under the table there, because in a way, one of the great things about this is that the Labour Party hasn't done that. Hasn't fallen into the trap of just simply playing, okay, we're going to drag all these people's families.
Some
in.
Sections of the left wing press, though, have been knocking on about Cameron and Osborne's rich families for a very long time, yeah. And I think that is, it's it's a fair point that people are saying, that it's not okay whichever direction that accusation is thrown.
Well, if it's okay, then we'll all have to get the boxing gloves off and not complain about the blood.
So ultimately, I mean, my experience with Daily Mail readers is that they have found this rather disgusting and distasteful. Do you think it's backfired?
Yeah, it has. I mean, absolutely it has. I mean, the editor of the Mail has forgotten the oldest rule in the rule book, which is that when in a hole, stop digging. I mean, they got themselves into a hole, and they should have stopped digging, but instead what they do, they sent some reporters to a memorial church service to listen in and to start asking the guests some questions, and then they started putting the boot in again, and
a few minutes ago, the Daily Mail executive is demanding an apology over claims of anti-Semitism. The Daily Mail will not say sorry to Ed Miliband over its attack on his late father, one of the paper's senior journalists has said. City editor Alex Brummer told the BBC the paper was owed an apology over claims that Ralph Miliband's articles were motivated by anti-Semitism.
Well, I think we need an apology from the Daily Mail for supporting Hitler and the black shirts in the 1930s. And Lord Rothermere, of course, who owns the Daily Mail, pays his taxes in France or Monaco and lives in Wiltshire. I mean, you know, there's another statement that people sometimes make is those who live in glass houses should not throw stones.
Indeed.
Never mind digging holes.
Well, it wasn't just the Daily Mail supporting Hitler in the 1930s.
No, indeed.
It was also,
yeah.
Well, and also Lord Reith, the founder of the BBC, was a big supporter of Hitler.
In actual fact, the wealthy classes in Britain were appeasers. But as you can imagine, left-wing Jewish refugees from Nazi Germany were not appeasers. And they found the British ruling class rather unpleasant because they were appeasers. That's the history behind all of that.
But it was, surely this all started because the Daily Mail believed, anyway, that Ralph Miliband found English people bigoted and he didn't like it here.
Well, you'll find that George Orwell had pretty much the same things to say about the ruling class in Britain at the time. It was a fairly common opinion on the left that the ruling class in Britain had been soft on Hitler, and Churchill was a lonely voice in the Conservative Party throughout the 30s. Most of the rest of them thought Hitler was actually doing quite a good job, including the Queen Mother, incidentally. But of course, Miliband's family, being refugees from Nazi Germany and left-wingers, didn't see it like that.
Including the King, Edward VIII. He was a big fan,
as Michael Heseltine pointed out, Ralph Miliband served in the Royal Navy on D-Day. So to accuse him of being unpatriotic is... Well, it's basically beneath contempt.
Okay, on to our next story. And this is, we're not going a million miles away from the BBC, because there was a lot of complaints last weekend that the BBC failed to cover in the national news. A big demonstration of something between 50 and 60,000 people in Manchester, outside the Conservative Party conference, Save Our NHS. And people bust across from all over the country. The BBC didn't feel it was, they were able to even give it a mention. And so we're going to hear now from Len McCluskey, who's one of the speakers at that rally of 50 to 60,000 people marching outside the Tory conference.
My mum, who died last year, aged 96 years of age, she lived in sheltered accommodation. The last 10 years, she was looked after on a daily basis by wonderful carers. And the last 8 weeks of her life was in a nursing home, where the most fabulous, dedicated and compassionate staff and nurses helped her die with dignity, the way she had lived her life. All provided, colleagues, by the welfare state, a welfare state that my mum's generation fought to build. It was the bravest, most humane vision a nation could have for itself. And we're not going to allow a bunch of greedy bastards from public schools to take it away from us. So when Cameron and Clegg talk about reorganisation and reform, we know that they mean fragmentation and privatisation. They don't value the health of ordinary people. They only know how to put a price on it. That's why we must make certain that the NHS is at the top of the political agenda at the general election, and that the next Labour government doesn't betray us like the last one, who was seduced by market forces and PFI. Our message to Cameron is crystal clear. You will have to come through us, through the ballot box, to take our National Health Service from us. And to the private healthcare companies hovering like vultures, I say, don't get too comfortable, for this is our NHS, and we will take back anything your slimy, corrupt hands steal. Comrades, keep the faith and keep fighting.
Well, so Unite's General Secretary there, Len McCluskey, speaking in Manchester last weekend, as not reported by the BBC. Well, Metro newspaper did cover a 50,000 rally outside Tory conference amid censorship row. And they've found that the BBC journalist claimed he was actually stopped from filming the demonstration by security guards inside the conference centre. Norman Smith, the BBC's political correspondent, said security staff had been told by police not to allow access to a balcony which was overlooking the protest, but no reason was given, Martin.
Well, that sounds pretty lame to me. I mean, the BBC should have reported it.
They could have been outside, couldn't they? I would have thought.
Well, exactly. They could just speak to camera and say, well, there's a demonstration. So that's pretty lame.
I mean, what he's saying there also is that he's blaming Labour as well, yes. Martin. He's not letting you off the hook.
Well, I mean, I'm when I was last in work, I was a member of Unite, and I would be a supporter of Len McCluskey, so I actually agree with him. And of course, the Labour Party, when it was in power as New Labour, did many things which we're not very happy with, and that opened the door to the privatisation of the health service, which we're now seeing. So that was very clear. It's very hard for us to argue against it. And we got a similar blowback, of course, with Lord Mandelson talking about the tax on the on privatised utilities. But the Labour Party is a broad church because it's a big party and an aspirant to govern the country, and therefore, of course, it's got a variety of views in it,
including people who want to start the NHS on the track to privatisation.
Well, I mean, I'll just point out that David Cameron himself, when he was running for election last time, said there will be no top-down reorganisation of the health service. That is a promise that's been completely ripped up.
And what are your thoughts about this particular protest and whether it's censorship or not, Mark?
I must admit, I did know about the protest, and I get most of my news from the BBC, so I'm not sure that they didn't.
I think it's on the website, but it wasn't on the news 6 o'clock or 10 o'clock.
They probably the TUC didn't get as much coverage as they thought that they should or were deserved. But I mean, it was covered. Saying oh, we couldn't film them from the balcony, so we didn't film them is a bit silly. Because, you know, if you can't film them from the balcony, then go and film them outside. I mean, clearly that's the way it's going to be. So I don't think it was censorship. I think, you know, they've got to. This is the thing, though. If you organise a protest at the same time as a major conference, with the specific intent of attempting to disrupt that conference, one of the potential risks is that instead the media will all cover the conference. Because, well, I mean, what, let's be clear, what the TUC were trying to do.
But they're not. They certainly weren't trying to disrupt it. They were trying to
steal all the coverage. But when you do that, you run the risk of not getting the coverage. That's a fundamental risk that you run up against if what your goal is to steal the coverage from another event.
But isn't 60,000 people giving up their Sunday news?
Like I say, it was on the news. I mean, they wanted it presumably to be top news and to dominate the conference news. But, you know, I mean, I guess it didn't. I mean, I don't get to order what the news order is. But what is more interesting to the whole of the nation? Is it a TUC march, of which there are quite a lot on, you know, these kinds of things? Or is it hearing what the Tories say they're going to do if they win the next general election, which includes a lot of horrible things? And I think actually it's pretty important that the public hear them. I think it's pretty important that the public do hear that if the Tories win the next election, they'll deny all benefits to under 25-year-olds. It's important that the public hear that so that they don't vote Tory.
Martin, finally, was it censorship or not, do you think?
Well, I mean, we could argue about whether it's censorship or not. I think people are going to turn up to conferences and what have you. You have your conference, people are going to protest against it. Both sides should be reported. That's what ought to happen. I think the hard politics of this are tougher. I mean, we're not going to go on with this topic, but it would be interesting to hear what the Liberal Democrats... I mean, the Liberal Democrats have drawn lines in the sand about this privatisation of the health service, and in a way, that's going to be quite crucial for you, I think, in terms of how you're perceived by the electorate.
Okay, he's pointing not at me, but at Mark. Thank you. Mark, also, because you're a bit of a, well, I wouldn't say IT guru, but you know a little about this stuff, we had at last... Newsnight last night, a really good interview with Glenn Greenwald, the journalist who's been covering most of the revelations yes. from June over Edward Snowden. So let's have a little listen to that now and see what you make of it.
I think it's a shock that government officials lie to the face of journalists who don't seem to mind very much. You had people defending the GCHQ on the grounds that this is only about terrorism or pedophiles. And yet, much of the reporting that we've done proves that's a lie. We reported that the GCHQ and NSA are spying on Petrobras, the large Brazilian oil company that funds social programs in Brazil. Are there terrorists in Petrobras? Or that they're spying on the Organization of American States when they're negotiating economic agreements? Are there pedophiles at the OAS? So I think that the job of journalists is to prevent people in power from lying to the people over whom they're ruling. And while some of this may be devoted to terrorists, huge amounts of this system are devoted to innocent people in the population whose privacy is being eroded.
So what are your thoughts generally about the Snowden revelations? We had a few months to digest them. Do you think it's a bit of a storm in a teacup or not?
No, it's not. It's huge. I think what Snowden's done is fantastic. He's blown... I mean, we all thought there was probably quite a lot of stuff going on, but Snowden has blown it wide open. It's much, much worse than we ever thought. He, in my opinion, is an IT hero. And there aren't many IT heroes. Most IT people are, you know...
Geeks.
Geeks, yeah, fancy.
Like me.
Well, there aren't many geeky heroes, but, you know, he is a geeky hero. He's... And, you know, it's much worse than we imagined. It really is much worse than we imagined. You know, they're secretly... putting legal pressure on companies to tell the government everything about us, everything that we deal with. You know, it's really bad. And actually, it's not a storm in a teacup. The storm is not big enough. It should be a much bigger storm. You know, and peculiarly in Britain, it's much less of a storm than it is almost anywhere else. In European countries, Germany in particular, and some of the other northern European countries, they're really, really upset about this. They're upset about the level of spying that Britain has been doing on their citizens. In America, they're really upset about this. And the whole, it's only been knocked off the top story by the whole shutdown of the government and the Republican madness. But in Britain, annoyingly, it's very quiet, and MPs are not getting upset about it, and I'm really annoyed about that, actually.
Okay, well, maybe they're spending a little bit too much time on their summer break and their party conferences, and they'll get stuck in when they get back to Westminster. But we heard yesterday Liberty's groups are taking GCHQ to court. Yes, this is just down the road, of course, up in Cheltenham, over web privacy. There are four European civil liberties groups which are launching a case against GCHQ at the European Court of Human Rights, accusing the British intelligence gathering agency of illegally intruding on the privacy of millions of people across the continent. The legal action concerns the alleged hacking of masses of online data, including emails and social media. British organisations Big Brother Watch, English PEN and the Open Rights Group, along with German internet activism group Konstanz Kurz, will argue this breached Article 8 of the European Convention on Human Rights, which guarantees the right to a private family life. Now, Martin, it looks to me as if, yet again, as we've seen so many times with the security services, they're using this whole thing of national security to actually commit crimes.
Well, yes, I mean, we talk about this quite frequently on this show. I mean, I think it is a lot worse than people realise, but I think the real political effect is what was mentioned in the clip, is that people really don't want industrial espionage to be carried out against their companies. I mean, this is what's why the Brazilians are annoyed. You're trying to sign trade deals with us, the same with the Germans, but you are actually spying on our negotiators. And on that basis, your trade deals are off, and it looks like this EU NAFTA deal, which was on the table, could be scuppered by these revelations. Mm. We're not going to negotiate with you if you're spying on our negotiators. So you can whistle for your trade deal. I mean, WTO deals, all the rest. It's all off as long as people are going to be spying on us.
So what's going to happen then, do you think, with the GCHQ? We've got at the moment, it's overseen by the Intelligence and Security Committee and the Joint Intelligence Committee, which is chaired by Sir Malcolm Rifkin. Now, he has shown himself really to be a very great friend of the security services, not really much of an independent MP at all. In fact, he's even paid by one of these defence contractors' financial services firms.
Well, yes, and I think people are beginning to be aware of the existence of a military-industrial complex whereby people work in security and then move into the private sector with information that they've gained working within the government structure. And, of course, this is very sinister. It's not just, I mean, I mentioned the economic espionage there, but of course there are other implications as well.
Any thoughts of a fix?
Well, I mean, we need some new laws which limit the behaviour of the security services. We need the existing laws to be enforced.
And also, of course, I mean, it's just occurred to me, it's also the technology is running away so fast. Often there aren't simply the laws are not there to control it. I mean, we've had this just this September, new laws implemented, for example, to govern the use of biometric data with school children. Mm. Up until this September, a school could take fingerprints, take iris scans, mm. and all this kind of school kids in order for them to get their library books, and there was no regulation of it whatsoever. So the technology is quietly coming in, often, we know, often happening with youngsters, and there isn't simply any legislation to deal with it. But we've got an even bigger problem with GCHQ in that it's all supposed to be secret.
No, indeed. I mean, and that what you just mentioned is a subject that is close to my heart. Some years back, I think it was 2009, I got a motion passed through the council condemning the use of fingerprinting of children for any reason, and calling on all schools in Bristol area to get rid of fingerprinting of children. I think there was only three or four schools at the time that were doing it. Let's be perfectly clear: there is no need at all to fingerprint children for anything. You know, schools have existed for hundreds of years and done their dealings with kids, and they didn't need their iris data or their fingerprints. They can do just fine without such things. Kids shouldn't be being fingerprinted. Well, I think the public, you know, the public isn't angry enough about this yet, and I'm not quite sure why that is. I think maybe you know, us politicians, we need to do a bit more rabble rousing to get the public a bit angrier about this, in order to get some of the laws changed, in order to rein in the security services. This is happening in other countries, but in Britain, unfortunately, it's not happening. And I it's a shame about Malcolm Rifkin. I quite like the guy. He's one of the more reasonable Tories, but he jumped up very quickly to the defence of GCHQ and the security services long before the reality of the situation had become clear, and he couldn't then backtrack. He needed really to do his job a bit better, which is to be a supposedly independent chairman of this committee, and I think it's probably time for him to be replaced with a slightly more bullish MP.
It's interesting, isn't it, over in the United States, where we had this partial shutdown this week over there, and yet the same week as a brand new data centre is opening for the National Security Agency.
I think that they are unfortunately funded from a different revenue stream.
Yes. The one that the Republicans
won.
Yes. we'll talk about that, Martin, because there is quite a lot of secret money in the security services, isn't there?
Well, listen, the whole war on terror industry is way out of control. And there is, I mean, for example, I'll just give you one example. In Turkey, senior military and intelligence people have all been sent to prison for a long period for orchestrating terrorism in Italy. It's not in Italy, that's happened in Italy as well, in Turkey, in order to steer politics in the direction they wanted it to go. And Erdogan, who's has put quite a lot of those people in prison. Now, people have got to remember that the Turkish army is part of NATO, and this kind of manipulation by the security services of politics is part of NATO's standard operating procedure, not just in Turkey. And we really do need to put the security state under democratic control, because it's way out of control as we speak.
Okay, we don't often have stories about Newcastle, but we've got one this week. Newcastle councillor David Stockdale is to be investigated over his link to the Freemasons. Well, Labour councillor who's in charge of closing down libraries in Newcastle is at the centre of a declaration probe. The man tasked with closing down those libraries is undergoing an investigation that he failed to declare that he's a Freemason. Councillor David Stockdale did not mention his Masonic membership on the council register of members' interests. Now, is this important or not, Mark? Because actually what he's saying is, well, there's no little box there saying, are you a member of a secret society, so I don't have to declare it.
Yeah, it is important, and I'm surprised in this day and age that people think that, first of all, that they can get away with that, and second, that if they try and do it, it won't be a problem. You know, I mean, I think these societies are a lot less prevalent than they used to be. I think that's probably fair to say. I mean, I know in Bristol people joke a lot about the merchant venturers and that kind of thing, but that's a slightly different organisation. But you know, these secret societies, if you're a member of one, you know, you have to declare it if you're going to take a public position. It's as simple as that. You're not at liberty to be a public elected official and be a member of secret organisations.
Well, he says he is, because there's no little box on the declaration of interest form to say, are you a member of a secret society?
Well, it says here, under council rules, Masonic activities must be registered. Five lines up from the bottom.
Yeah. Well, Martin, what are your thoughts about this?
Well,
I mean, he's a Labour councillor, of course.
Well, if you think back to Paulson in the 60s, Labour, the Freemate, you want to be controlling the planning committees and so on. This is the fear. So if in cities like Newcastle, that's going to be Labour. Although I think the Liberals did control Newcastle at one time, did they not?
Yeah.
But I think from my point of view, he's just got to. If he wants to be a Freemason, that's fine. But he's got to declare it, and we've got to know about it.
And what happens is, if someone has got a... See, this is the difficult thing, isn't it? If you don't declare someone, no one hears about it for a little while, and then they suddenly realise afterwards, hey, they didn't declare that interest. What do you then do about it?
Well, what I would suggest is if you didn't declare it to the Labour Party before he was selected as a candidate, he should be deselected. I mean, and also, as a Labour Party member, I wouldn't vote for anybody as a candidate who was a Freemason. That's the way you discipline those kind of people. People can join anything they like, but they've then got to be honest about it and face the consequences.
Of course, the worry here is, Mike, I mean, we had Jack Lopresti during the early 2000s actually did declare he was a Freemason in his declaration of interest, because in those days there was a little box that says, are you a member of a secret society? And he said, well, yes, I am, I'm a Freemason, but it is not, underlined twice, a secret society. Fair enough, at least he's declared his interest. What bothers me is now there isn't that box there, and also what about those that don't actually declare it? I mean, maybe Jack is the only honest Freemason anywhere near the council.
Yeah, sure. I mean, clearly, if this is going to continue to be a problem and councillors are going to say things like, well, there wasn't a box, so I didn't tick it, then we just need to put a box on there again.
What about the sanction, though, Mark? What should
the sanction... I mean, it's interesting. I mean, it's difficult because you need some kind of precedent in order to judge what magnitude of sanction there needs to be. I mean, perhaps, you know, being suspended from the chamber for a month or something like that is a reasonable sanction. I mean, how serious is the non-declaration of something? It is true that councillors sometimes do forget some of the more marginal declarations that they're meant to make. Sometimes it's not entirely obvious. For example, you know, councillors are often governors of schools and governors of other charities and various other bodies which may get funded via the council. It's not always obvious that you need to declare things like that, you know, in some of the things that you do, because you know, being a governor of a school, you might think, well, that's a fairly normal thing. Well, but what if the school is getting a giant grant from the council, lots of money? Then, you know, is that a conflict of interest and things like that? So we need to keep a balanced measure of what the punishment for failing to adequately declare interest should be. I don't think it should be, you know, total expulsion forever. But I think something like a suspension for a month would be sensible.
No, putting them in the stocks on College Green. Anyway, finally, Michael Mansfield's lawyer, and it's not there, Martin, so don't flick through looking for it, but his legal practice has had to close down because of legal aid cuts. So just a quick thought on that.
Well, I mean, obviously, the UK Uncut are protesting about legal aid cuts as we speak, and we've had various lawyers on here arguing against it. It's basically withdrawing legal support for poor people. So they don't get, and actually they need legal support quite a lot of the time.
What were your thoughts on the legal aid cuts, then?
Yeah, I must admit, I'm a bit bothered by it. I mean, I think there is an issue that's raised about, you know, would people launch some of the court cases that they do that cost huge amounts of money and might be classed as slightly frivolous if they weren't getting aid? That is clearly a different issue to the fact that, you know, we've got to enable poor people to be able to defend themselves against abuses by others in society, and sometimes they need the courts in order to do that. If they need the courts and they need access to funds to be able to defend themselves, then we need a system that delivers that.
Well, what he says is nowadays there's one rule for the rich and another for the poor, an article in The Independent. Anyway, that's all for now. Murdoch News at 6 time. Thanks to this week's guest. That was Lib Dem councillor for Cabot Ward, Mark Wright. After the news, after 10 months in the job, has she made a difference? It's Sue Mount-Stevens.
BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, it's emerged that a whistleblower tried to...